Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
We've reached the end of a good old-fashioned bidding war. A chain of for-profit colleges worries about its bottom line and what baseball fans really care about. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In New York, I'm David Gura, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Friday, June the 20th, and it's great to have you with us. We'll start with the week that was. It's the weekly wrap, and here in the studio with me, we've got Lee Gallagher with Fortune. Hey, Lee.
Hi.
And we've got John Carney from the Wall Street Journal. Hi, John.
Hi.
Let me start with the markets, John. It seems that every day I get an alert on my iPhone that we've hit a new record. We've hit a
new highs.
Exactly. So today is no exception. The Dow's hit another record. The S&P's an all-time high. What are we seeing here?
Well, what we've seen is almost, even though we keep making new highs, things move very little on any given day. We've had a record number of days where the stock market has moved up or down by less than 1%. So we're sort of slowly grinding higher, but there's almost no volatility. And a lot of people find it an almost eerie calm.
Lee, would you agree? A bit eerie?
I would agree, yes. And I mean, you know, volatility has almost, you know, it's sort of vanished from the market. I mean, if you remember back, you know, not last year, but the year before, it was just all over the place. And it just started going up last year and it really hasn't stopped. And I think people are used to that and spoiled by that. So, you know, I think I'm among the people that think we're in for a bit of a shock probably later this year.
Let me ask you a bit about the Fed had its regular meeting on Tuesday and Wednesday. Janet Yellen came out and did her press conference afterward. There was a lot of talk leading up to that about indications of inflation. We got the CPI report earlier in the week. What did Chair Yellen have to say?
Well, I mean, she has done a good job, I think, at being very artful with her words, which she's known for. I mean, she was really pioneered the use of communication as an actual tool in itself. But, you know, she was trying to reassure us that growth is, you know, happening and that there are improvements in the labor market. And I don't think inflation is too much of a concern. I don't think deflation is too much of a concern. I think the biggest problem is the D word, demand. And there's only so much the Fed can do to spur that.
John, I was struck by how much we talked about this mythic taper for so long. And now it's right. Like we go into these meetings and it's sort of a foregone conclusion. It seems like nothing.
Right. And what's actually the irony is interest rates have moved up a little bit the last couple of weeks. But we were supposed to have rapidly rising interest rates and a lot of volatility around the taper. Instead, we didn't get that. I actually found the most shocking thing about the Fed meeting is the long-term projections of where the interest rates will eventually be are coming down, meaning instead of aiming – everybody thinking we'll go back to 4% long-term, it's now down to like 3.75, and that's a change.
Just sticking with what was happening in Washington, Mary Barra, the CEO of GM, was back in Washington again. Obviously not a fun trip for her to make, appearing before members of Congress. Have we learned anything new about sort of the problems within the company that have led to all these recalls?
I mean, you know, no, we have not. And I think the irony in all this is that GM's car sales now are actually doing quite well. And there are a number of reasons for that. But, you know, look, this is a serious, serious problem. This is not something Mary Barra expected, and she has been hit with this. And I think she's managed it very well. I think she came out and took decisive steps right away, and this is not going to go away anytime soon.
There's a really weird symmetry between what happened with the banks and what's happening with General Motors, right? We rescue them, and then it turns out there's all these calamities out there, right? And they end up having to pay lots of money for things they did a long time ago. And, you know, that's one of the disturbing things here is that we had sort of hoped, okay, we're like clearing the decks, we'll move forward, and now it turns out there's these – you know, big problems that have existed there for a long time.
Just very quickly, John, I wanted to ask you, we've seen all of this action happening in the Middle East and gas prices going up in some places. What's been happening with oil markets this week?
Well, they went up a little bit, but I don't think they went up anywhere near enough. I mean, there's a possibility for the biggest war in the Middle East in decades, and yet we've added like $4 or $5 to the price of crude.
John Carney with The Wall Street Journal, thanks very much.
Have a good weekend.
Lee Gallagher with Fortune Magazine, thank you.
Thanks, David.
A quick update now on healthcare.gov. The new Health and Human Services Secretary, Sylvia Matthews-Burwell, announced she's creating two new positions at HHS, a chief executive, a CEO, responsible for running the federal health insurance marketplace. She also plans to name a chief technology officer. She's not wasting any time. She's just been on the job for under 2 weeks. On Wall Street Today, as you just heard, records every which way. We'll have details when we do the numbers. A bidding war has been going on for a while now over a French energy company called Alstom. Germany's Siemens, together with Japan's Mitsubishi Heavy Industries, raised their bid for the company this morning to around $19 billion. In the end, though, General Electric won out. Well, sort of. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler explains.
As a company, Alstom has two focuses, its energy business and its rail business. None of the companies bidding for Alstom want the train business. They want the turbines, steam and gas turbines.
It's actually a very good deal for General Electric because it's right in the vein of what they already do.
Daniel Holland is an equity analyst at Morningstar. He says the deal has dragged out because French politicians worry about the consequences.
The country of France is really concerned with, you know, jobs and then also technology security.
France wants to protect its nuclear secrets. As part of the deal, GE would create 50-50 partnerships with Alstom in nuclear and renewable energies. And GE has promised to add thousands of new jobs. But that may not be enough. Even though French officials have declared General Electric as the winner, they also called for GE to submit a revised proposal.
The French government is completely capable of screwing up this transaction.
Cliff Ransom is an independent equity analyst. He says the French government is involved in the business negotiations for the wrong reasons.
To think that they can, in the name of national pride, derail what would have been a very positive transaction, already approved by the GE and the Alstom boards, is probably ludicrous, if not preposterous.
In the end, it looks like politicians will be more than gatekeepers. They'll be business partners. The French government says it intends to buy about 20% of Alstom. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
The Department of Education has announced plans to increase financial oversight of Corinthian Colleges Incorporated. That's a big chain of for-profit schools headquartered in California. The Department of Ed says Corinthian may have lied to prospective students about their job prospects after graduation, among other things. The government's decision will make it harder for the company to get access to federal financial aid money. And because of that, Corinthian says it may have to shut down. Marketplace's Noelle King has the story.
There are about 72,000 students enrolled in Corinthian colleges. They get about $1.4 billion in federal financial aid every year. The Department of Ed says it will stop Corinthian from accessing those federal funds for 21 days. Corinthian says it may be unable to continue as a going concern. But for a big company, 21 days without access to funds doesn't seem like a long time.
I think that's what's so eye-opening about this situation.
Michael Tarkin is a senior analyst with Compass Point Research and Trading.
It sort of signals how thin their capital levels are to begin with. You know, clearly they do not have much room for error here.
Because almost all of their income is federal aid, just a fraction is tuition dollars. If Corinthian shutters schools, its students, who are enrolled in everything from degree programs to trade schools, will need backup plans. William Tierney, co-director of the Pulia Center for Higher Education at USC, says public colleges in California, where Corinthian schools are based, simply don't have room.
We don't have the capacity to take 30,000 students or 10,000 students, even 5,000 students more into the public sector. We're maxed out.
Some will have a hard time finding other schools to fit their course of study.
You can't just send somebody somewhere. If I'm studying cosmetology, you can't send me to USC.
And some will probably decide that college just isn't for them. I'm Noel King for Marketplace.
Turns out the type of school you go to can determine how likely you are to default on your student loans. You can check that out at our new education page. That's marketplace.org/learningcurve. New Jersey spends millions of dollars on legal fees for lawsuits that involve police. And it's not just civilians bringing those lawsuits. Police are suing police. Officers are suing other officers. They're suing departments and the towns they work for. Reporter Sally Herships has done a year-long investigation, and she found that between 2009 and 2012, cases of police suing police cost New Jersey taxpayers $29 million.
Take the case of Cassandra Smith. She worked for the Camden Police Department for 20 years, and she was the first woman there to be promoted to captain. That same day, she was assigned an unmarked car. She says she was so excited, she went out to the parking lot to take a look at it.
And opened the car door, and just so happens, just the way the interior light illuminated the inside of the door pocket, and there were approximately 3 bags of crack cocaine in the door pocket.
Smith says someone planted the drugs because they were angry a woman was going to be captain.
How are you feeling at that moment?
Just disbelief. Disbelief. This is big league. It's hardball. I could have very well not just ended up being terminated, but could have virtually ended up in jail.
Smith says that was just the beginning. After other incidents, she ended up suing for sexual harassment and discrimination. Her case was eventually settled for $165,000. People involved with the case say there's a whole other side to the story, but sometimes it's just easier and cheaper for all parties to settle. We found cases like Smith's across the entire state. Cops accusing cops of harassment, retaliation, discrimination, but no one is trying to fix the problems that caused them.
Is there recourse for officers in your situation besides lawsuits?
If there are, I am not aware of what the recourse would be.
Smith's only alternative would have been to go through internal affairs. But it turns out internal affairs answers to the chief of police. And Smith says her problem was with the chief. Antonio Hernandez is president of the National Coalition of Latino Officers. He says he hears about cases like Smith's all the time in New York and Pennsylvania.
I once had a lieutenant joked with me and said, you know, if internal affairs walks in here right now, tells you to dress in a pink tutu and put on a dance, you better put it on because if not, you'll be fired.
Hernandez calls the problem chiefs gone wild. He says the state and county should do a better job at monitoring police internal affairs in New Jersey, but they're not. And that can leave room for petty infighting and retaliation and lawsuits that can run into the hundreds of thousands of dollars. Lou Ryder used to be an officer. Now he's a consultant who audits police departments for insurers. He says the number one reason for these lawsuits is sloppily run internal affairs investigations.
That's what gets you into trouble when we don't do it right.
Ryder says internal affairs investigators have to know the rules, especially if they're in a union department. They have to know every nuance of collective bargaining. He says oftentimes the difference between a good department with no problems and ones with internal disputes comes down to the chief. Ryder's job means he visits a lot of police departments.
At the end of 3 days, we know who the thumpers are, the people who like to use force against people. We know who the skirt chasers are, the ones who are trying to use their position of authority to work up dates. We know the persons who are avoiding calls. Now, if I know that in 3 days of being on scene, everybody in that department should know the same thing.
But Ryder says, behind the department, if you look in the background, often you'll find unions. So states where officers are organized, like New Jersey, Florida, and California, have more lawsuits. John Shane says another part of the problem comes down to the way police are hired and promoted. He's a professor at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice and a former captain in the Newark, New Jersey Police Department. Shane says bad police departments can be run like kingdoms, where an officer's loyalty is valued over his ability.
In the hands of an autocratic manager, that rule book can become oppressive, and I can use it any way I see fit because there's a rule for everything. And I know that I'm going to be supported on the inside by my bosses. So I just then open up the page and find you without your hat, your shoes aren't shined, you're 3 feet out of your sector, and I'll charge you for it. And so goes the wheel of internal justice in the police department.
Joanna Schwartz is a professor at UCLA who studies police lawsuits. She says most police departments around the country don't pay settlement costs out of their own budgets. A lot of it's covered by insurance.
There is no financial pressure on those departments to take proactive measures to reduce the numbers of settlements and judgments.
In the business world, these lawsuits would be a huge problem. But no one in New Jersey even seems to be tracking the cost. The Attorney General's office, which oversees internal affairs for the state, says these cases should be bumped back to the towns. Schwartz says police departments should be tracking them. But she says most departments don't even know how many lawsuits are opened against an officer.
The next incident or the next interaction that that officer has with someone could become that high-profile case. So if you're interested in resolving little problems before they become big problems, it's very important to assess that information in a proactive way instead of waiting for the next catastrophe.
Everyone I spoke with outside New Jersey's government agrees the internal affairs system needs reform. But at this point, no one in the state's government seems to be paying attention. In the meantime, the lawsuits and legal fees keep coming. In New Jersey, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Coming up, how do you get fans to go to a baseball game these days? You give them stuff.
Regardless of how popular the team is, it could be as much as a 15 to 20,000 seat bump, depending on what we're giving away.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 25 points, a tenth percent, to close at 16,947. The NASDAQ was up 8 points, 2/10%, to end the day at 4,368. The S&P 500 advanced 3 points, a tenth percent, to close at 1,962. For the week, the Dow rose 1%, the NASDAQ powered up 1.3%, and the S&P 500 picked up 1.4%. Used car behemoth CarMax revved up 16.5% on a jump in first quarter earnings. A better jobs market and continued low interest rates have boosted auto sales. Rival AutoNation, the largest auto retailer in the U.S., drove up more than 5%. Europe's markets were mixed. Britain's FTSE advanced 0.25%. In Asia, the Nikkei dipped less than 0.1%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.60%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is a nonprofit, listener-supported program, and your support in any amount helps us keep on telling the stories behind the business and economic news of the day. So please help us end our budget year strong by giving at Marketplace.org by June 30th.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Monday. The House Committee on Veterans Affairs holds a hearing on the capacity of the VA to care for veteran patients. The National Association of Realtors tells us how many existing homes were sold in May. And a box of chocolates was just not the same after this. Forrest Gump premiered in Los Angeles 20 years ago on June 23, 1994. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm David Gura, in for Kai Ryssdal. During the last 30 years of his life, Claude Monet made some 250 paintings of water lilies in his garden in northern France. One of those paintings is up for sale. Sotheby's is scheduled to auction it off on Monday. And that Monet is worth a lot of money. Bidding starts at $33 million. Maybe you've seen one of Monet's water lily paintings at a museum. You've probably seen a reproduction elsewhere, on a tote bag or a coffee mug. Anyway, those water lilies are everywhere. Monet knockoffs are big business. How big? Marketplace's Dan Weissman has been asking around.
If you want to put a Matisse on a coffee mug or an Andy Warhol or a Jackson Pollock, you're going to have to talk with Ted Fader or one of his employees.
We're going to say no, but you have to talk to him.
Why will they say no?
Because it's the schlock factor.
Fader runs Artist Rights Society, and he represents the estates of most of 20th century art's greatest hitmakers, Picasso, George O'Keefe. Not Monet, though. Copyright in the U.S. expires 70 years after the artist dies. Monet died in 1926, so his work has been public domain since 1996. Since then,
people are free to do whatever and commit mayhem on his work.
Much of that mayhem is done by Art Plates. Mike Mason is the sales director there.
We do switch plates, mouse pads, coffee mugs, and our travel mug, which is our famous Mugsy, which is our hottest item.
If you are looking at a Monet mouse pad in a museum gift shop, Mason says it was probably made in his company's California factory. 20 workers on 14 machines can turn out up to 5,000 pieces a day. He says Van Gogh has been the hottest seller for the last year, but some things are evergreen.
Monet does very, very well because the brighter the color and the more, you know, vivid the color, the more it shows up on different items.
If you go to the Metropolitan Museum online and search Monet in the gift shop, you'll get 72 results. Mason says some of them are his, but not the neckties.
That we don't do. No clothing.
In Chicago, I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
The Los Angeles Dodgers play the San Diego Padres tonight in Petco Park. The Dodgers are 40-34 this season, just barely above 500, and it's fair to say the high-priced team's performance has been disappointing. Even though the Dodgers aren't winning lots of games, when it comes to attendance, the team is doing great, packing Dodgers Stadium. Attendance-wise, the franchise leads the majors. Well, it turns out that has absolutely nothing to do with baseball. From KPCC, Ben Bergman reports.
Look at the most attended Dodger games of the season, excluding opening day, and they all have one thing in common. When you scan your ticket,
thank you much.
Depending on the game, you get a barbecue apron, a Mother's Day clutch, a giant inflatable chair, or the most popular item of all, bobbleheads.
Bobbleheads are worth more than a ticket.
Dodger fan Tony Manerick walked through the gates on a recent bobblehead night for ace pitcher Clayton Kershaw, where tickets went for five times the normal price. When the Dodgers offered a package selling just games where bobbleheads were given out, it sold more than every other package combined. That's not surprising to Stephanie Rozil, who stands on the upper deck of the stadium with her Kershaw bobblehead still safely in its box.
Everybody collects them. It's kind of like cool to put them out. It's like having a little player in your home. Who doesn't want to take Kershaw home with them?
Like many fans, Rozil says she chooses which games to go to months in advance based on just one factor, what's given away.
You know, like if you're going to come to a game, you pay the money, you pay for parking, you might as well get something that you like.
Major League clubs handed out more than 2.5 million bobbleheads last season. That's twice as many as they did 5 years ago, according to Sports Business Journal. And no team gives away as many bobbleheads as the Dodgers. The reason is simple, says Vice President of Ticket Sales David Siegel. When it comes to getting people in seats, giveaways are as close to a sure thing as there is in baseball.
Regardless of how popular the team is, it could be as much as a 15 to 20,000 seat bump, depending on what we're giving away.
Siegel won't disclose how much the Dodgers spend on giveaways, which every year get more elaborate. Some of the cost is defrayed by sponsorships, but he says the money is well spent. The Dodgers field the most expensive pro team in the world. But as this season has illustrated, a roster of stars provides no guarantee of winning. So Siegel says the Dodgers try to think beyond baseball.
Obviously, we are tied to that, and that's our core business. But we want people to come out here regardless of how the team is playing.
Key to giveaways is uniqueness. There are only 50,000 or so made, and you can't buy them in the shop. And like the little toy buried in the Cracker Jack box, there's no underestimating the value of free prizes. There's also the nostalgia factor, says Irving Rain. He's a sports marketing expert at Northwestern.
Those giveaways mark relationships. You know, see, I remember 3 years ago when I took Jimmy to the game, you know, the first time, and we got this bobblehead doll.
Ceramic bobbleheads have been sold at ballparks for decades. But before the late 90s, there was usually just one generic version for each team, or historic figurines. There were fears featuring one player would be bad for clubhouse chemistry. The Dodgers hosted their first bobblehead nights in 2001, three of them. This season, there's 10. and fans can't seem to get enough, according to team historian Mark Langell.
They don't even care who we play, what time, what day of the week it is. It doesn't matter if you play the game at 6 in the morning on a Tuesday. People are going to want their prize.
There have been some notable misses over the years. A baseball giveaway in 1995 sold out Dodger Stadium, but the game had to be suspended when fans threw their free baseballs on the field, upset the manager, was ejected. It was the first National League game to be forfeited in 41 years, all because of a giveaway gone wrong. In Los Angeles, I'm Ben Bergman for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note about another major auction house with a big ticket item up for sale. It was not a painting by the father of French Impressionism. It was, however, a work of art in its own right. The prototype for the world's first integrated circuit, the first microchip, mounted on a piece of glass. Well, Christie's tried to sell it yesterday. Auctioneers called it virtually the birth certificate of the modern computing era. They estimated it would sell for more than $1 million. In the end, no one wanted it, or no one was willing to pay enough for it anyway. It didn't sell. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 25 points, a 10th percent. The NASDAQ was up 8 points, 2/10 percent. And the S&P 500 advanced 3 points, a 10th percent. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace was developed by J.J. Yore. Marketplace is produced by Sitara Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer. I'm David Gura. Kai will be back here Monday. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.